movement. The Kia bounced on its worn shocks as someone pushed down on the rear bumper. He heard the rustling of the tarp and the scraping sound of blocks being moved against one another. His heart began to race, his hand finding the plastic pistol grip of his rifle.
"Am I compromised?"
He slowly moved the selector switch to semi-auto, making far more noise than he'd hoped, but whoever it was didn't seem to notice as the scraping of the concrete continued. The blocks were a facade stacked on top of wooden slats just above Nizar's head, and removing one or two would surely reveal his position. In a matter of seconds, his mission could be over.
"What are you doing?"
an authoritative voice cried out in Arabic from what sounded like 10 or 20 meters away. The movement of the blocks came to an abrupt halt.
"I am just looking at these blocks. These are good blocks," the nearby man responded. "Those blocks are not yours, old man. Get away from that truck before I have to arrest you."
"I was only looking."
Nizar felt the man step down from the bumper.
"I am sorry, sir."
"Go now."
"Yes, sir. Thank you, sir."
Nizar could hear the man scurry away on sandaled feet. Heavier steps approached and a bright light blazed through the cracks between the blocks. Nizar put his head down and closed his eyes, not even daring to breathe, hiding from the police officer's flashlight like a child under sheets. The seconds ticked by slowly before he heard the light click off, and after a pause, the boots moved away. The sniper audibly exhaled. No more sleep would come this night. His thoughts wandered to memories from his youth, his father teaching him the virtue of patience under the thin metal roof of their family's farmhouse. Their perch in the loft was not much different than this one, cramped and dank but comfortable on a cushion of hay. The muted form of the golden jackal circled the goat's pen, but Nizar couldn't see the sights in the pre-dawn light. The old British rifle felt huge in his hands, and his neck craned forward uncomfortably due to the length of the stock. He could hold it only by resting the long wooden forend on a rolled-up blanket. He could smell the tobacco on his father's breath as he whispered to him to stay calm. Nizar shook with excitement, but his father's voice slowed his breathing and steadied the tremor of the iron sights. When the jackal circled again, the gray light had turned pink, and he could make out the rectangular post through the rear notch. His father's repeated words became almost a hum as he began to squeeze the World War I rifle's heavy trigger.
Calm.
As dawn broke, the city began to come alive. Engines coughed, dogs barked, birds chirped, and children shrieked with laughter. Even during war, life went on. Among the many sounds of urban life, one stood out for Nizar, the ringing of church bells. Al-Hasaka was home to Christian churches as well as mosques, and instead of the call to morning prayer echoing from a minaret tower, the bells of the Syrian Orthodox Church clanged in the distance. Under the cover of darkness, Nizar had rotated the concrete block in front of him so that he could see through the hollow end. He had broken the center section out so that neither his suppressed muzzle nor scope would be obstructed. He observed the increasingly bright area around Haddad's front door through the 4x magnification of the Russian PSO-1 scope mounted to the side of his VSK-94 rifle. It was an ugly black thing that looked like the stepchild of the ubiquitous AK-47, with half a meter of tubular suppressor in the front and a boxy stock to the rear. Nizar cared nothing about its odd looks. Instead, he found beauty in its function. The home was surprisingly modest. The one-story structure was surrounded by a low stone wall topped with an iron fence that extended 8 feet above street level. There was no sign of guards, armed or otherwise, though Nizar assumed that the gate was at least locked. The sloping range estimator engraved into the scope's reticle allowed the user to bracket a man's height and establish an approximate distance to the target. No one moved within Nizar's field of view, but he could see the front door, which he used for the same purpose, taking into account that the door aperture would be slightly taller than the average male figure for which the reticle was calibrated. The range was just over 100 meters, which was an incredibly short shot for a sniper of Nizar's talents, particularly from this stable shooting position. This rifle and its cartridge were engineered for maximum stealth, the suppressor masking the report of the shot and the bullet flying at less than the speed of sound, so as not to create a sonic crack on its way to the target. As a result, the 16.8-gram subsonic bullet dropped like a rock, which made knowing the range to the objective critical. Nizar had to piss, but he dared not move since the target could appear at any moment. He hadn't come this far to be caught with his dick in his hand. With the rising sun came the encroaching heat, violating his confined space, his cloth headscarf quickly soaking through, sweat stinging his eyes. The waiting was always uncomfortable, but that was the job of a sniper. Chapter 5. Aboard the Bitter Harvest, Atlantic Ocean, November. The days following the storm allowed Reese time to think. One beautiful sunrise followed another as he sailed onward. The headaches he knew would eventually kill him came and went. They felt like a million small shards of glass grinding together inside his brain. There was no rhyme or reason to when they would hit, so there was nothing Reese could do to prevent them. He thought of his family, his beautiful wife and daughter. He thought of all those who had helped him over the preceding months in his quest for vengeance, particularly his friends Marco Del Toro and Liz Riley. He hoped they were okay. He thought of Katie and his last words to her. And he thought of Rafe Hastings. During his last year of college, Rafe began looking seriously into fulfilling his dream of becoming a SEAL. Reese still had another year of school, but trained hard with his friend to get him ready for the rigors ahead. Rafe's father was a bit hesitant about the prospect of his only son following in his footsteps to life as a commando, and gave his blessing on the condition that he start in the enlisted ranks before becoming a commissioned officer. Reese decided to go the enlisted route a year later, as he wanted to focus on building his tactical skills before assuming a leadership role. In today's Navy, there are programs that allow aspiring SEALs to enlist with the specific purpose of attending BUDS, the brutal 6-month selection and training program with 80% attrition. Things were different in the late 1990s. SEAL recruits would attend basic training at Great Lakes, Illinois, before attending an A school, which Reese always thought stood for Apprentice School, before going to BUDS. Reese's enlisted rate was Intelligence Specialist. His 16 weeks of training took place in Virginia following boot camp. He had to complete the school for a job that he never intended to do before he could even attempt to become a SEAL. The thinking from senior-level military bureaucrats was that if only 20% were going to graduate BUDS, they had better train up the other 80% ahead of time in occupational specialties needed by the Big Blue Navy. The result was that Reese and Rafe took similar paths, but were separated by a year. Reese arrived at Coronado to begin BUDS just as Rafe was completing his SEAL qualification training course, and he was able to attend his friend's graduation. As he watched the man whom he considered a brother shake hands with the commanding officer, he knew that he wouldn't quit until he too was standing at that ceremony. If the instructors didn't want him to become a SEAL, they were going to have to kill him. After the stories they had heard from Reese's dad about the SEAL teams in Vietnam, Reese and Rafe both thought they would be off on secret missions as soon as they crossed the quarter decks into their first teams. The reality was different. No secret missions to hunt down terrorist leaders and rescue hostages. This was peacetime. And peacetime meant a lot of training. That, they quickly discovered, was their job. To train. To be prepared. To always be ready for the call. Then, on a sunny Tuesday morning in September 2001, that call came in. Rafe had made it through the vaunted Green Team and had multiple deployments under his belt as an assaulter at Naval Special Warfare Development Group when a Master Chief convinced him to become an officer. That meant attending Officer Candidate School, OCS, at Naval Station Newport, Rhode Island, where the Navy turned civilian candidates and enlisted sailors into butter bar ensigns in a matter of weeks. Expertise in folding underwear and t-shirts, somehow qualifying one to lead men into battle. Reese had spent a few years in the enlisted ranks learning the trade, gaining tactical experience, and earning a reputation as one of the most competent snipers in the teams before going to officer candidate school, mostly due to Rafe's influence. It took a few years for their paths to realign, and when they did, they found themselves on the same battlefield during the height of the war as platoon commanders in a SEAL task unit in Ramadi, Iraq. The fighting was hot and dirty that summer as a civil war erupted across Iraq. The Sunni-Shia rift that traced its roots back to the death of the Prophet Muhammad in AD 632 was playing out in its modern incarnation. Throw in al-Qaeda in Iraq, tribal loyalties, Iranian influence, and a dysfunctional government propped up by a foreign military and political machine, and you had all the ingredients for a caustic cocktail of violence. When their task unit lost two men to a roadside bomb, they pulled out all the stops to dismantle the threat network, eventually finding the cell leader, Hakim al-Maliki, through a tactical human collection effort that Rafe spearheaded. Just prior to launch, a mission to capture, kill the cell leader responsible for the deaths of their teammates was called off by senior-level military leaders. The Blood Brothers dug until they found out that al-Maliki was a CIA asset, part of a long-term deep penetration program of AQI. The agency wanted him alive and working his way up to a position that would give them actionable intelligence on Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the radical jihadist leader who rose to prominence as the leader of AQI after the U.S. invasion of Iraq and was currently public enemy number one. Feeling responsible for the deaths of his teammates and knowing where the CIA-protected cell leader would be for the next two nights, Rafe went off the reservation. He used the tactical human network to deliver a package to the AQI safehouse. That package mirrored the IED profile common in Ramadi at the time, a backpack containing a device consisting of a fertilizer-based main charge with commercial detonators from Pakistan sent Hakim al-Maliki to his 72 virgins. When the CIA accused him of taking out their prized asset, Rafe neither confirmed nor denied it. The CIA wanted him prosecuted for murder. They put the screws to the one officer rumored to have been in the source meeting where details of the assassination were discussed. But James Reese didn't say a word that could help convict his friend. Without Reese's testimony, there wasn't enough evidence to take Rafe to court-martial, and doing so would have exposed CIA sources and methods that they preferred to keep quiet. But to appease what had by that time become known as the interagency, Rafe was removed from the country, pending the outcome of an official investigation. He was sick of seeing his men die in what he saw as a war without end due to the blunders and missteps of senior military and political leaders. Tired of a bureaucracy that tied their hands with absurd rules of engagement and a system that, as Lieutenant Colonel Paul Yingling famously noted, imposed harsher punishments on privates who lost rifles than on generals who lost wars, Rafe didn't look back. He left the SEAL side of his life behind and dropped off the radar. He saw the birds first. You wouldn't expect to see a massive clump of birds out in the middle of the ocean, but here they were. They circled and dove like a flight of Stukas, scores of them. Anglers paid tens of thousands of dollars in sophisticated marine electronics to locate bird activity of this kind. Stumbling upon it blind was more than a bit of luck. The turbulence on the water was visible from hundreds of yards away, and Reese jumped to the wheel, steering toward it. Dashing below, he retrieved a rod stowed in clamps on the ceiling of the boat's salon. As he approached the churning water, he jerked the main line to leave the sail flapping in the breeze, the boat's progress creeping to a mere drift. From the bow, Reese bent backward before snapping the rod forward over his shoulder, flinging the free-spooling Rapala into the wad of baitfish. Good cast. Flipping the bail back over on the big pen, he began to reel briskly with his rod tip pointed toward the top water frenzy. It took 30 seconds to reel the lure all the way back to the boat, and he quickly made a second cast. The line snapped taut and nearly jerked the rod out of his hands, and Reese eased back on the drag so as not to break the line. He let the fish take it, not being able to power the boat in its direction to take up any slack. Reese could almost hear his father coaching him through it.
Let him get tired, son. Just be patient.
This reel held a ton of line, so he let the fish wear itself out, stripping most of it. When the fish turned or otherwise gave him a chance, Reese pumped the rod upward and reeled as he let the tip down. This dance lasted for at least a half hour, the fish stripping line, Reese fighting it back with increasing force. The muscles in his arms and shoulders burned, and his lower back ached, but he could sense his quarry's exhaustion. He couldn't help but think of Hemingway in his current plight.
You are killing me, fish.
Reese reeled harder as the fish began to give up ground, bringing him closer to both the boat and the surface. He saw a flash of silver as the fish streaked by the bow, the sight of the white hull sending it surging away.
Nice tuna.
He walked slowly toward the transom as he reeled, bringing the line to a position where he could land his catch. Holding the rod in his left hand, he worked with his right hand to lower the folding swim platform. Stepping onto the teak decking, he felt the cold ocean waves splash onto his bare feet. He didn't want to fall in, but if he did, at least the boat wasn't moving. 10 more minutes passed as he fought the tuna. At this point, he was pumping and reeling aggressively to capitalize on the fish's fatigue. He reached with one hand to grab the gaff, his wet hand slipping as he worked to remove the rubber tubing that was protecting the razor-sharp hook.
This sure would be easier with two people.
When the thick monofilament leader broke the surface of the water, he reached up and grabbed it, wrapping it in loops around his left hand. He swung the gaff hard and missed, cursing himself. The fish swung around in a small circle, and he swung again, burying the hook into its shining flesh. He jerked upward and fell backward in one motion, dragging the 80 or 90-pound fish onto the swim platform. With one hand on the leader and one on the gaff, he hoisted the flapping yellowfin up onto the aft deck between the two steering wheels. He held on to the leader and gaff like a man possessed, determined not to let this fresh source of protein fall back into the sea. The tuna writhed and gasped, then went still, seemingly as exhausted as the mariner foe who landed him, its massive unblinking eyes staring skyward. Grabbing a towel that was hanging on the rail to dry, Reese threw it over the fish, covering its eyes to prevent it from finding the